Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Jim Brown's Outbreak Capercast. This issue continues with the audio updates to Chapter 6 of my book called Among the Multihulls, available from Amazon, of course. And Chapter 6 is entitled The Multihull Context. And you loyal listeners know that it's the subject upon which I've been harping all along. You know, the emergence of multihulls really was a symptom of the times, the post-war period in which they emerged. But I would like to hit the high points here again because I see certain parallels in our times today and those of the early post-war period, 1950s, 60s, 70s. And furthermore, we have a whole bunch of new listeners. I am so pleased to say that our listenership is climbing healthily. I'm here to express my gratitude and welcome to those of you who have just stowed away on board. You are apparently among many others who say that they would rather listen to my yammering than read the book. Well, I guess that's because you can listen while doing something else, like driving. And as I go along here, I throw in stuff that's happened since the book was published. So, like the previous chapter 5, it took me 2 editions of the podcast to get through all that stuff. And I have the feeling that's going to happen again here with Chapter 6. And by the time we get to Chapter 7, I think I'm going to have some important new news for you all. It depends on how things go at our big deal meeting down at the Mariners Museum, scheduled for February 9th. So we'll start now in about 1970 and try to bring you up to speed, all right? Here we go. In the podcast just before this one, the previous episode, I asked Christy to read out loud to you the letter from Captain Andrew Siegel. He told us about all the sailing he had done in a 37-foot sea runner, which he named Skipping Stone, but she was originally called La Una, the One, which was built by my particular friend, the late Jerry D. Rush. So, yes, indeed, Jerry was the first one to buy plans for the Sea Runner 37 from me and Joanna. It was back in about 1968, and boy, we really needed the money. They paid cash. Jerry and his wife, Patty, they were a very energetic couple, and they really fit into this subject I've been yakking about called Stepping Stones to Sea Running. And the last few podcasts, I've been tripping over those stones, starting with our little Juana, and then me getting into business and designing the 38-footer, they called off-soundings, and then the Manta, and then the Sea Runner 25, and then the Sea Runner 37, okay, and that's La Una. Yeah, Joanna and I were living in this great old house on 7th Avenue right in the heart of Santa Cruz there, just a few blocks from the harbor. We were just starting to crack the nut on our design business. And we were really broke. And when these folks handed me all this cash, I don't know, it was $300 or $400. It was a fortune to us at the time. I came home and sort of tossed it all over Joanna's lap. She'd been singing that old jazz song, Get Out of Here and Get Me Some Money Too. Well, Patty and Jerry built their boat in another part of town, but not far from us. They had a really ramshackle rented house, but the landlord let them put up a big shelter in the yard. So La Una was built undercover, and we had a lot of sessions there, you know, planking parties and stuff. And as the boat was nearing completion, Jerry was really overwhelmed. He was holding down a full-time job as a physical therapist at the time, and Patty was contending with all of their kids from 2 previous marriages. But they got to know a guy who became very interested in the boat and was helping Jerry, and he did a good job of working his way into the crew. Turned out when they finished the boat and took off across the Pacific, they figured they needed another crew member with them, and so Greg Edmondson went along. Now, Patty and Jerry were not inexperienced. They had had a Piver Nugget and sailed it down the California coast, around Point Conception, down to Los Angeles. And as they were rounding Point Conception, their rudder gudgeon broke. Same thing happened to us in Wana. I mean, it was a constant battle with the gear in those early days, but there they were off of Point Conception, you know. And they managed to steer the boat by dragging three plastic jugs filled with wine. Gallon jugs, that's right. They had 3 gallons of wine on board, and they had decanted it into plastic jugs so as it wouldn't break. But the bottles had finger grips on them, you know, so Jerry was able to tie through those and tie the three of them together and throw them overboard and drag them behind the boat. And to get the boat to steer to the right, he would haul this tow line over to the starboard side of the boat, and the drag would pull the boat around one way, and then he'd run across the boat and steer the other way. And here they are surfing around Point Conception. And that wine became very valuable stuff. All of the launchings that occurred for years afterwards, including Scrimshaw's launching, were celebrated with that wine. It was called sacred wine, and we used it to anoint the rudders of new boats, auspiciously hoping that they would never break anymore. So at Scrimshaw's launching, we not only had champagne squirting all over the place, there was this wine, you know, old sour stuff that turned to vinegar. There were several boats built in the Santa Cruz area that benefited from that anointment. And as far as I know, their rudders never broke. But anyway, Patty and Jerry took off with Greg Edmondson, left the kids with their previous parents, and hightailed it out into the Pacific. And it was a long voyage. They visited many places. Finally arrived at Pango Pango in American Samoa. And they were running out of money, so they hooked in the harbor there. Jerry got himself a job in the hospital ashore and was going off to work every day. And I don't know, there were difficulties. One thing led to another. And finally, Patty and the crewman, Greg Edmondson, took off. They eventually married, had a long, happy life as far as I know. I later spent an evening with Patty, and it was a very sad story. She really broke down, confessed as how she still really loved Jerry, but living on a boat and traveling like that was not for everyone. She assured me that it was not fitting for everyone. And I suppose it can be said that it was because of the boat that their lives went over a big bump there in Pango Pango. And to settle up with Patty, Jerry sold his boat to Captain Andrew Siegel, who is the guy who wrote that letter that Christy read to us last episode. And as you'll remember, Siegel sailed it a long way. Well, so there was Jerry out in Pango Pango with half of the money from selling his boat, and he heard about another 37-foot sea runner that was, I can't remember where, but it was way to the west. I think it was over in the New Hebrides or something. So he went over there, looked it over, discovered that it was built at least as well as the one that he had built, which I thought was beautifully done, and he bought it. The thing was for sale for a low enough price that he could buy it for his share of La Una. And he proceeded to sail that thing all over the Pacific, and a lot of it hard to windward, engineless. No engine in that boat. He finally made it down to the Bay of Islands in New Zealand and settled there, remarried, sold the boat, bought a farm. He and his wife had a very fulfilling time there, Joanna, and I had a chance to visit them. Jerry spent the last of his good health hacking away at the brush to make more farmland for growing tree tomatoes and sheep. Sorry to say that Jerry died at a relatively young age. You know, prostate cancer. But that's the kind of thing that went through my mind when receiving that letter from Captain Siegel and La Una, Sea Runner 37, number one. And incidentally, that picture on the cover of my 1983 book, The Case for the Cruising Trimaran, that picture on the cover is Jerry DeRush's La Una under sail in Samoan waters. One of those stepping stones. And it fits right into what I call the multi-hull context, because it was that can-do spirit of the time, get it on, go do it, that I think had such a whole lot to do with the emergence, let's call it the breakout, of the modern seafaring multi-hull. There was a lot of life in it and some death in it, and believe me, I could tell you stories like that till the cows come home. The trouble is that after 70 of these capers, I'm beginning to forget what stories I've told and what I haven't. We're supposed to be talking about the multi-hull context here. Let me stand back and have a long view at it for a moment with you. First of all, the multi-hull phenomenon is not new. The long view of this subject suggests that we consider our ancient origins. And I've often thought that the ancient Micronesians and Polynesians and Island Asians really had it figured out. Their boats did not have to carry heavy cargoes. They didn't have to carry cannons. So their hull forms could be really sleek, narrow hull forms, and therein lies the real secret to multi-hull efficiency. One can think of efficiency as speed, if one so chooses, but I think of it as something else, just the ability to get along on less, that is, make the boat move with very little wind, and also get it to go like stink when the wind blows, or when you get 100 men paddling on the thing like the ancient Pacific war canoes. That's fundamental to multi-hulls, narrow hull form. It has more to do with efficiency than any other feature, I think even more than lightweight. It's the ability of the individual hulls of a multi-hull to get through the water and the waves without pushing a whole lot of it out of the way. And the anthropologists tell us that many of these early multi-hulls were actually created as escape vehicles. They allowed people who had become victims of environmental exhaustion and political persecution to escape out into the Pacific Islands and distribute themselves over a wider area of Earth than any other race at the time. Now, to parallel that with today is a stretch, because now there are no more islands, no more uninhabited islands. But we certainly do have uncontrolled migrations. And in a way, I can sympathize with the notion of a wall across our southern border, but let's face it, folks, not even the Great Wall of China succeeded in stopping uncontrolled migrations and also military aggression. Now, maybe back in the 60s and 70s, there was the opportunity to find that certain sanctuary somewhere that must exist if you had your own boat and you could go look for it. A lot of us who built our own boats back then were really concerned about, nuclear incineration and democracy devolving into autocracy. So there are certain parallels today, but believe me, I'm not suggesting that your little plywood trimaran is going to protect you from radiation. And with all of the nuclear grandstanding that's going on these days, let's face it, there is at least the possibility that some other entity other than government could get their hands on nuclear weapons. And if we all start shooting off the big ones, believe me, the only safe place on the planet is probably going to be in the southern hemisphere. Maybe your boat would get you there in time. Maybe. And if you get there, you'll find that there are many hundreds of thousands of multi-hull vessels built on the ancient patterns with the ancient materials and technology still in daily service today. So when speaking of the multi-hull phenomenon, we must first give a nod to our ancient roots and at least consider the parallels and contrast between then and now. But concerning the modern multi-hull, of course, it was based on an Asiatic concept. It was culturally offensive. We had our own European or Eurocentric nautical heritage, which was very strong. I mean, it goes all the way from Nelson to Nimitz and from Hornblower to Jack Aubrey, all accomplished in boats that would carry cannons. And so when the modern multi-hull came along, it was culturally alien. So we must ask ourselves, what did it take for it to catch on in this environment, the modern multi-hull going mainstream. Well, as I've said, it took about 50 years and a lot of angst for it to catch on. There's a very strong antithesis between those who accepted the multi-hull notion and those who rejected it out of hand because of their commitment to, well, call it tradition, call it nostalgia. But it really took a paradigm shift in the nautical public's consciousness in order to accept this new notion of marine architecture. So talk about context. Let's just stand back for a bit here and try to list, have a look at, a close look at what's happened in the last 50 years or so. How has the modern multi-hull manifested itself in this turbulent time? Well, I guess we should start with the Hobie cats, the beach cats, the whole ilk, I think comprises something over 200,000 vessels, certainly among the most popular small day sailing class sailboats of all time. And then, for real contrast, let's put a beach cat alongside of a ferry boat. The modern, fast, multi-hull ferries, gee, they'll carry 1,000 passengers and hundreds of vehicles at higher speed and lower fuel consumption than anything in their class. Also, greater safety. How many times have we heard of overcrowded monohull ferry boats being capsized simply by all of the passengers on the upper deck running from one side to the other to rubberneck at something going on in the harbor? That doesn't happen with multi-hulls. It's that good old wide track stability. Of course, it makes a huge difference if under sail, but it also makes a big difference for operating under power. And then, of course, there's a whole lot to say about the ocean racing multi-hulls, particularly under sail. Arthur Piver was certainly right back in about 1965 when he said that all ocean sailing speed records would be held by multi-hulls. Again, I'll confess to be not terribly interested personally in racing, although it certainly does drive the technology. But I guess the latest round-the-world, single-handed, non-stop sailing speed record is now something just over 50 days. That's averaging something over 30 knots for sailing around the world with only one guy in the crew. Come on. Well, next on the list is the excursion boats. These are commercial vessels now. They've got to sustain their owners instead of the other way around. I'm speaking mostly of the day charter catamarans that are operating all through the warm water resort areas of the world these days. They've exposed millions, literally millions of passengers to the sensations of multi-hull sailing. They've become a very popular side trip for the cruise ship passengers who disembark in some island that they'll never remember the name of, but book a tour on a catamaran and go out and have the best time of the whole vacation. Come back and say so. And hey, then comes the multi-hull powerboats, particularly the trawler-type catamaran yachts. They are wonderfully commodious, a condo on two hulls. Some of them can go roughly twice as far on the same amount of fuel as their monohull equivalents, or let's say twice as fast on the same amount of fuel. Those may be slight exaggerations, but you get the point. Efficiency is the point. And talk about the multi-hull context. The next on the list is the military multi-hulls. Man, when we started playing around with our little plywood boxes in the Golden Gate, geez, we had no idea it was going to come to this. We might have stopped. You know, the Navy's new class of what they call the strategic ship, Independence class. They are very high-speed trimaran guided missile carriers loaded with all kinds of electronic surveillance equipment, and they're stealthy. You can hardly see them on radar, and they can operate in very shallow water. Some people call them pirate busters. But then, how about the little sailing trimaran stealth surveillance vessels that we saw on 60 Minutes a while back? They are unmanned sailing drones. Very stealthy. Some call them subseekers. Now there's another application for wind power for you, huh? Valuable for its silence. And last on the list, but most in my opinion, are the world-girdling cruising multi-hulls. Many of them built by their owners, even designed by their owners. And they sometimes take their families to sea in them for many years at a time. I think perhaps the net effect of that kind of sailing is that tend to come home with a far better understanding of how the world really works. That's not something you can get by sailing nonstop around the world single-handed. Oh, I forgot the America's Cup boats. I suppose that's what most people think about first. For me, it's last. But it's a wonderful last. Just imagine these America's Cup racing catamarans on hydrofoils with rigid wing sails and all of that stuff, you know, and go 50 miles an hour in a 20-mile-an-hour wind. Really? Well, it's the foundation of the future technology for extracting motive power from the wind for seafaring. Now, getting back to context, if we look back over this incredible list of modern multi-hulls, we see that they have a unique combination of features. That explains their acceptance into the modern world. They have remarkable seakeeping properties combined with shallow draft. If you put that together with real efficiency, including speed as part of efficiency, sure, it gives you an unprecedented combination. And it explains this, what I call this sea change in marine architecture. And I haven't even mentioned safety. My gosh, for many centuries, seafaring people have just assumed that it was possible for a boat to sink, and yet they would go out in the ocean in them. It became an accepted hazard. Whereas with multi-hulls, most of them at least, they are built out of buoyant materials, and there is no ballast weight to take them down, so they become really the first truly seaworthy, truly efficient, truly unsinkable seafaring vessels yet known to mankind. Now, it's true that multi-hulls of whatever type can be capsized. But one thing we've learned in the last 50 years is that the likelihood of multi-hull capsize is certainly no greater than the likelihood of mono-hull sinking. And we've seen that a capsized multi-hull can provide a substantial lifeboat for its crew, wherein they can survive for months and months. So, let's face it, the aftermath of mono-hull sinking is far more terminal than the aftermath of multi-hull capsize. Okay, so it's taken us a while to catch on to the real benefits of this unique combination of multi-hull features. And the reason I go on and on about it is because I just happen to have lived at a time and been involved in the breakout to present time multi-hull history. Because of all the America's Cup activity, there's been an increased consciousness in the public sphere of what modern wind power can be all about when it comes to sailing vessels. But none of that America's Cup publicity has made the slightest mention of its roots, its historical roots. There's been zero mention of the individuals who have spent such substantial portions of their lives trying to make this thing happen. And the stories of those lives is really a rich nautical tradition. But I guess because historians tend to neglect the recent past, I've been concerned, along with Scott Brown, that this incredible rich heritage was going to be lost. So we figured we'd start telling these stories. That's the nature of the podcast and the Outrigged project. The whole capers shindig is an effort to get these stories available so that they can join with all of the other nautical heritage that makes up mankind's relationship with the sea. But boy, telling these stories, it becomes quite a project. The Outrig Project. That's what we're all about here. There's the context for you. Except that I haven't yet mentioned the future. And so, if you'll forgive me, patient listener, I'm going to get up on a brand new great big soapbox now and ask the question, what's next with multi-hulls? What's coming down the line? Man, when I look back on the last 50 years, it's been just a stunning ride. Can you imagine the next 50 years or maybe the next 150 years? We may well be into some environmental and economic and political and geosocial changes that require us to make another paradigm shift in our approach to seafaring. A few caper casts back, I spoke of the hybrid wing and its combination with hydrofoils, all that action that's going up in Bristol, Rhode Island at the Fast Forward Composites, the incredible achievements of guys like Randy Smythe, and the anticipation, the excitement, the verve of what's coming next, indicated by guys like Tommy Gonzalez and his sponsor, Donald Sussman. These people are really looking to the future. And they're not the only ones. It's going on in monohulls, too. In fact, it appears that the next America's Cup is going to be sailed in monohull vessels that are hydrofoil-borne. Rigid wing sails and all. Will they overtake multi-hull development in terms of efficiency and performance? Maybe. I got my doubts. We'll see. The way things are going these days, let's face it, multi-hulls just could end up being a brief snapshot in nautical history, a flash in the pan. Personally, I think, well, they've been with us for a long time, and I think they'll be with us for a long time to come. To somehow conclude the multi-hull context, I like to look forward and imagine multi-hull, hydrofoil-borne, hybrid-wing-propelled commercial vessels. Okay, here I go again, but it's not hard to imagine a sailing multi-hull that's as big as a jetliner, let's say as roomy as a streamliner, that can really participate in human activity at a time when things like airplanes and automobiles have been forced into some kind of a decline. Let's say maybe it's because the permafrost is melting and putting out both kinds of greenhouse gases which interfere with the atmosphere, the amazing shield it gives us from solar radiation. It just dictates to us that we got to stop burning all of this ancient sunlight. It tells us that things like windmills and sailing ships are got a good chance of really advancing, coming back into play because of the application of modern technology to ancient concepts. And the way it looks to me right now is that there's just no better way to do that for watercraft than with multi-hulls. That's their context. That's where they fit in to the past, present, and future of humankind. I think they point the way ahead. So I'll step down now, but leave the soapbox, hoping that those among you who might want to contribute to this kind of a discussion will let me know. Let's try to bring some of your thinking into this monologue that I've been going on with here for 71 sessions. Huh? Thank you so much for your patience. I appreciate very much your listening and your contributions to help keep the Outrig Project going. And here's hoping that that story about the good ship La Una and this effort to place the multi-hull phenomenon into context will help inform all of you new stowaways on board of Outrig to understand what you're in for here. I hope you like it. If you don't, let me know. I need to know what you don't like about it. We can change it, okay? And we've got some new stuff coming up. We're just trying to share the lore. Bye-bye.